Good afternoon and welcome to the Tortoise Shack Sunday Special, our 42nd Sunday Special, which again, every week I remind listeners, is quite a depressing thing to think about because it leaves us, it means that this is just rolling on. But nonetheless, it is great to do these and interact with our listeners and our supporters every week. We have a packed agenda, so I'm not going to go on too much this morning. I'm joined by Vicky Conway of Police, Martin McMahon, Michelle Byrne, who is a trade unionist activist, and just a shout out, her own podcast, A Week at Work, is also well worth a listen as part of the Left Bloc Network, Never Let It Be Said. They're doing great stuff over there. Do check them out. And we're joined by Mr. I'm going to say politics nerd and Irish, Mr. Irish Politics Projections, Harry McEvan Sonia. And I did butcher Harry. Thank you. But I'm going to go straight. We are going to be joined shortly, if the line is working, by Hannah Salah from Gaza. She is trying to get in. But in the meantime, I just want to kick things off straight away and ask Harry, polls came out last night and you are a bit of a poll nerd. Do you want to give us just a flavor of that, if you don't mind?
Yeah, absolutely. First, thank you. Thanks so much for having me on, guys. It's really exciting. I'm really, really glad to be here first time. But yeah, it's we're in a really interesting place with all of this. And I think I think we're about to hit some kind of tipping point, it feels like, with everything that's been happening over the last week. Because when you look at the polling since the election last year, it's been kind of static. There's been an accumulation towards Fine Gael and Sinn Féin. People can see there's sort of an increasing division within politics between that kind of almost the left centering around Sinn Féin and the right centering around Fine Gael and the decline of Fianna Fáil. And anyone can kind of see that from what they're looking at. But what we've had this week, the last poll that came out, the Ireland Thinks Mail poll that came out today, really, really interesting for a couple of reasons. So firstly, what you're seeing is there's that Sinn Féin are kind of increasing a bit, and that's kind of standard for Ireland Thinks. You're not seeing a huge amount of difference there. But there's a subset to that polling, which I think is very, very interesting. That's to do with two things, to do with housing and COVID. And I think that's going to sort of set a flavor for what's going to happen over the next little while with those things, because the numbers on housing, and there were two polls in this, there was part of the Ireland Thinks, and there was also the Claire Byrne Live one that happened, is that Sinn Féin are far and away more trusted on housing than Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And what we've seen is Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, because they decided essentially to have a fight with each other over the last little while, eventually to contribute to pushing this massively up the agenda now and centering this around something that really, really isn't good for them. And in terms of what that means for the left in general, but particularly for Sinn Féin, who have been obviously the most public and vocal and had the biggest platform on their kind of housing plan, is going to be something that's, you know, it's going to potentially be something that changes how we look at things. Now, obviously, we're a very long way away from any election. There's a lot of things that can happen. But if you have that building of that narrative and that building of that accumulation of support around it, that could really push them into a position where suddenly they potentially could be leading a government. Because if you look at the numbers, right, when people were given a choice between the three, I think 44% of people said they would trust Sinn Féin more. When they did the poll earlier in the week on just overall trust numbers, everyone's were on housing, everyone's were bad. But Sinn Féin's were still nearly twice what Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael's were. They're about 24%, and Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael were around, I think, 14, 15%.
Just going to interrupt the podcast now for a few seconds to let listeners know that the Tortoise Shack continues to put out as much content as we possibly can, but we really do need support. We have covered a lot in the last week. There's been phenomenal podcasts, including the two Norries with Gabor Maté, Vicky Conway's Policed with a brilliant insight into terrorism legislation, Caroline on Glow West with, and I'm laughing because whoever thought we'd be saying orgasm inequality, but we are. We cover that. And Reboot Republic has had three podcasts in the last few days. And you know, I suppose people will point at the Oliver Callum one, but my favorite is the one with Momobo, so just go check them out. Don't miss them. But if you like what we're doing, please support us. It won't be around if we don't get support. It's not viable. It doesn't pay for itself. It doesn't pay for the opportunity costs. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into producing hours of content every week. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I can't put it any simpler that if you think that you enjoy, or if you said, you know what, actually, if I met Groves in the digger some evening, I'd buy him a pint. Well, buy me a pint virtually. You know, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It really would help us and keep us going. I'll let you go back to the podcast. Thanks for the support. Thanks for the messages. Thanks for all of the thousands of you who are listening. It means a lot. But if you can, help us out. Go that one step further. Thank you.
But Sinn Féin's were still nearly twice what Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael's were. They're about 24% of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael were around, I think, 14, 15%. Of people actually believing they can do it. And when you then look at what's been happening with the Cuckoo funds, with obviously with Dara O'Brien's personal investment, I don't think that story is going to particularly go anywhere. It reflects kind of that as we come out of COVID, as restrictions start to lift, people aren't necessarily turning around and rewarding the government for that, but they're changing their focus back to the underlying crisis that's been going on beforehand and looking to express that, because the numbers on COVID for the government are actually really good at the moment. On the last poll, I think the positive view was about 51%, and negative was a lot lower, I think 21%, which essentially was a reversal of where they were a month ago. So people are feeling that a better job is being done on managing the pandemic, but that's not being reflected in support numbers for the government. They're effectively flat, despite having a huge swing towards people saying that they're doing a positive job over the last month. So I think a lot of those parties, particularly I think Fianna Fáil, given Stephen Donnelly's ministry, would have been hoping to get some kind of bump out of that, some kind of improvement in fortunes, and basically be rewarded, I suppose, for the end of the pandemic, despite I think people might question the quality of the management throughout it. And that's not manifesting immediately, although we've already seen a change in the level of support for just the government's approach. If that doesn't reflect in polling numbers, that's going to be really, really a problem for them, because ideally, I think what they were looking at was when the pandemic finally ends and things get back to normal, as it were, people would say, OK, great job. We've got through this huge crisis. The government have led us through this. They've done a good job. And although people are kind of coming around to that way of thinking, it's not actually making them more likely to vote for them. And that's going to be, if they can't capitalize on that and they can't turn this, because that's a huge opportunity to build support and to say, you know, we can handle the worst things that are thrown at us. And instead, people are just turning back their attention to all of the other crises and all of the other problems that are going on as a result of this government. What's going to dominate moving forward. And that's going to be very difficult for them to actually convert that into what they want to build. So in terms of that latest poll, again, the numbers themselves don't tell a huge story. But it's very interesting in terms of when you look at, again, that supportive polling on COVID and on housing, to see how the public, what the public's concern is just changing, rather than being a case of, okay, well, this is fine. Good job, guys. We're going to reward you for that. And I think that's going to be interesting to look at moving forward and to see if that sort of trend continues. Because if so, that's very good for Sinn Féin.
Eating bread is soon forgotten, Harry, in that once people are vaccinated, well, that's that over with, and it's what have you done for me lately? And I think when we look at the results, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael combined are coming in at a couple of percentage points below where they were during the election. But Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin, are, if they were together, they're above where Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael were at the last election. And although there hasn't been much of a movement in the smaller parties, the Greens have seen a big drop in their support. That's probably the bigger story of the polls. Would I be correct in thinking that?
I think that that's part of it. So there's two aspects to that. Firstly, on current numbers, and obviously, again, we're a long way out, but on current numbers, it wouldn't be possible for anyone to form government without Fianna Fáil, unless Sinn Féin and Fine Gael went in together, which obviously is not going to happen for a variety of very obvious reasons. But Fianna Fáil is essentially in a position where they hold a balance of power. Now, their numbers are bad, and if they continue to decline, that situation will change, but that's the most likely outcome. So, you know, when you say about Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil potentially having to be looking at each other moving forward, if there was an election tomorrow and we had an outcome based on the current polling numbers we have, that's probably what would have to happen, unless Finafall wanted to stick with Fine Gael, which I think if they're in any way smart, they probably would want to disentangle themselves from that, because it hasn't gone very well for them so far. In terms of the smaller parties, there are a couple of things, and it's not a huge, like you say, you know, it's a couple of percentage points either way, but those obviously have huge impact for parties that are polling at less than 10% anyway. The Green Party support is about half, I think, of what it was at the election at this point. It's a very significant drop, and potentially, again, could lose most of, if not all, of their seats at an upcoming election. I think that's a risk that the party was willing to take when it went into government. I think the people who are in the parliamentary party who were in favour of government potentially expected that as an outcome, and that's a calculus that they've made. I think we can talk about my own personal experience and how much I disagreed with that during my time in the party, which I'm no longer a member of. But everyone, I think a lot of people on both sides saw that coming. I don't think people saw it coming this quickly. I don't think they saw it plunging into the Green Party effectively turning itself into a punch bag for so many of the government's problems. But they absolutely have been punished, because their supporters, you know, Fine Gael are doing well in the polls because this is kind of what their supporters expected. You vote for Fine Gael to get this kind of thing. The Green Party, not so much. And I think we've seen a lot of that drop away. And there's been two aspects to that. I think left-wing people are going towards the Social Democrats in particular, but also towards Sinn Féin to a lesser extent. And the sort of more conservative people who the Green Party did a good job of reaching out to during the election. I think the Green Party, one of the things they did quite well was sort of try and be that bridge for people who had voted for right-wing parties to make their first move towards the centre-left and then potentially beyond. I think a lot of those people have gone back to Fine Gael as well, because what was the point? What was the point of voting for the Green Party if you might as well just vote for Fine Gael? So that's a problem for them. And other small parties are having some interesting things. Like the Soc Dems are doing really well at the moment. They've almost doubled their support, taken a lot of that from the Greens. PVP's polling is actually quite concerning. Overall, it's fairly static, but if you break it down, they're doing actually relatively well around the country for where they usually are. But the numbers in Dublin are really bad at the moment, and that's got to be a huge concern for them, because that's their main support base. Other than obviously Solidarity's Mick Barry down in Cork, all of their people are based in Dublin, and a lot of those seats are going to be at risk, which is a huge problem that the left hasn't been able to sort of convert this the current crises we're having into that actual level of support in terms of polling and electoralism. I know that PVP aren't super focused on electoralism, but it still hurts them, and it hurts their profile, and it hurts their ability to organise and raise their voices nationally if they don't have people in the poll. So I'd be worried looking at those numbers for them. And there is one other thing that's interesting when we talk about small parties, and that's Aintu, who I don't know who their electorate is. I really don't know who their support base is. But they're outpolling the PVP at the moment, albeit marginally. In the last two or three polls, they've actually even been ahead of the Green Party. Now, we're still only talking like 4%, you know, 2-4% support. But that could be enough potentially to make them competitive to return another TD or two, particularly up in some of the border areas.
Could well make them king players in a tight election, and they could go either way. I mean, I'm not going to say it's a strange setup. It's a different setup to what we're used to. It's a left conservative lean to it, which is, we're not used to that. It's usually right conservative in this country. So it's an interest. They are interesting. I suppose it's worth caveating all of this with that once an election is called and minds get focused, the incumbents tend to drop in support.
Yeah, there's certainly an element of that. I mean, obviously, we all saw what happened in 2020, where it wasn't even after the election was called, it was literally within 3-4 weeks before the election that people came around to Sinn Féin and made a huge swing over a period of time. If you graph it out, like the support goes like this, and then it comes to like 2 weeks before the election. So really, really remarkable. But again, while there is an element of that that's certainly true, it's always very hard to predict what's going to happen exactly. And I mean, at this point, you know, you would expect Fine Gael, for example, support to have suffered to an extent, but they're improving, particularly in Dublin, which is the last place you would think, given everything that's happening with housing. So you never know. Generally speaking, yes, if things are going badly, there is a focusing against those incumbents, against those governing parties. But it's going to be so much depend on the circumstances under which we have that election. Like if this government drags itself out to 2025, if something happens beforehand, like when we come to the Taoiseach swap over Fine Gael, like actually maybe we can take advantage of this and get a few more seats, which they probably will on current numbers. So it's very difficult to to say for sure how that will work out. Well, in general, I think you're correct.
What we can say is there's been an inexorable drop going on for 20 years in support for Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. And in reality, we are now a left country. More people vote to the left than vote to the right. So it's probably going to be the most interesting election, the next one. And I don't think it'll go to 2025, really and truly, Harry. I think once enough people are vaccinated that feats can go on the street, there will be more than enough issues. And when, okay, the government has a majority, but when you've lost the room, you've lost the room.
And isn't there also a dimension to that whereby, like, COVID has enabled a lot of people to focus on what really matters to them and what their priorities are? And, you know, we could very easily see a winter discontent, you know, this year where people are just like, no, I know what I want in my life and you're not giving it to me.
Michelle, any thoughts?
Yeah, there's the poll I was looking at as well with the individuals, where it had top three people was Harris, then MacDonald, then Bradker up as a top. And that's two Fine Gael out of the top three who are polling high. And it really strikes me that they're Fine Gael individuals, and there's this whole individualization of these leaders. And I suppose, especially with all of the housing stuff that's coming out and how it's connected to Fine Gael policy at the moment, we really need to connect those individuals to the party and then the parties to the policies. Like, whether Simon Harris has a viral TikTok or not shouldn't determine whether he's doing well in a poll or, you know, like, those off-the-cuff videos are definitely not off-the-cuff. They're part of a wider PR strategy. And it's just really annoying to see so many people kind of, like, fall into that trap to make them personable. These politicians are personable, and therefore they're getting the votes. But people are forgetting that they're actually voting for the party behind them. Mm-hmm. Like, it is the Fine Gael policy that gave the cuckoo funds the money. Like, it is their policies that we're still dealing with now. But the way that it's been set up, that Micheál Martin is obviously the Taoiseach, he's getting the blame, and so is Dara O'Brien getting all the blame for all of the policies that were put in place before this. It was very strategic to put Fianna Fáil in first in this rotating
scenario. I'm going to have to cut in there. Harry, thanks very much. Tony, back to you there.
Yeah, no, sorry. Thanks very much, everybody. We will come back. Hannah Salah has joined us from Gaza, and I want to, first of all, thank her for her patience in trying to get in. I know it's been difficult. Hannah, thanks for joining us this morning. This afternoon in Gaza. How are you and how are things there?
Thank you, Tony. As you know, the escalation is continuing. Today is the day number 7. And last night was hard for all Gazans here, because the Israeli strikes continued to target civilians. Last night was very hard because they destructed many buildings in the same time. Many people were under the rubble. At least 30 dead bodies were removed from under the rubble today. And at least 12 were still alive from this rubble. The situation is getting harder, actually. We in every day we expect that the truce will be coming soon, but the escalation is continuing to expand. The last Israeli strikes put pressure on the health system. They are receiving the dead bodies as parts, not a full body, and many families and relatives are there to try to know where is the dead body of their children, so they can know them and start mourning the dead bodies. The death toll started to at least reach 180. Including at least 40 children and at least 25 women. The number is increasing when we say at least, because this is not final and they are still counting the number of deaths. Some of the injured cases were transferred to Egypt because there is no abilities and capacity for local hospitals to receive and treat these cases. So there is a big pressure on the health system. The streets in Gaza were hit hard. It was like digging rockets that destructed the street. Municipalities were warning that this will increase the suffering of civilians, because ambulances cannot move from one area to another area to take the injured cases and save their lives. Even if someone want to move from a home to another, taking a shelter, they cannot move easily in the streets. So the situation is getting hard. And this is inside Gaza City. But in other cities in the southern area, also they are having other types of strikes that hit also residential buildings. Today, the colleagues of Al Jazeera and AFP, were, Al Jazeera and Associated Press, were received by AFP. They are in another residential tower, Western Gaza City. We are praying that this tower will not be targeted, because last night they have targeted another residential tower, but it was not destructed totally like the previous ones. They destructed a few departments of these towers.
Hannah, they've systematically taken out a lot of the infrastructure. I know you've had problems with internet, 15 hours without electricity, access to water and food is going to become an issue. And now you're saying that the hospitals are becoming overwhelmed. Last night when we were talking on the phone, you felt that there was talk of a truce. Has this progressed at all? Is there any talks of a truce now, or is it just that? Because the situation has escalated so far that the truce has gone off the agenda.
Yes, but before talking about the truce, the situation of people, civilians here is very difficult. The UN agency, I think OCHA, they mentioned that 10,000 Palestinians in Gaza are displaced. They don't have the main services, even access to water and hygiene kits. This will affect them. Ministry of Health was warning that this is hard to deal with, because this will lead to a third wave of the pandemic, because the number of people who were receiving the vaccine is very limited, and not having these safety measures inside the UN schools where the displaced people are living now is not good for them. This will put also pressure on the Ministry of Health, because it don't have the capacities to deal with a big number of critical cases that might be affected by the COVID-19. Regarding the truce, there is no progress. I just heard Al Jazeera correspondent, and he said that there is two choices, incursion inside Gaza City or a truce. So the both choices are very far from each other, a truce or incursion. Incursion meaning that there will be escalation or expanding for the escalation. They will enter by their tanks inside Gaza City. This will cause extra damage. They will face the resistance. There will be a conflict. They may kidnap Israeli soldiers to make exchange deal and to pressure on them. This will be hard for civilians, because they will start to randomly shell the areas to clear it from any resistant member or doubts that will affect their operation. So this will be hard for them. For the other side, for a truce, there is negotiation that is ongoing. The Israeli are not accepting the conditions that they are put, the Palestinian factions are putting, including stopping the violations in Jerusalem, and easing more restrictions on Gaza, and accepting to facilitate the reconstruction of Gaza. Some of these conditions are not clear for media yet, but I did not hear any of Hamas members or officials were saying about any progress in the truce. They continue to launch rockets from Gaza. Just a few minutes from now, they launched a new round of rockets, and I think that it will reach a big distance, like in Tel Aviv and other cities. They are trying to pressure the Israeli citizens to pressure their government to stop the escalation in Gaza, because the number of killed cases and the damage that they cause reach the level of war, not only a mere escalation as it is known now.
Anna, it's been a very difficult week, and I know it's been traumatic. And but in terms of the toll that it's taken on the citizens of Gaza, is there any? I know the UN Security Council is meeting today. again, has there been any sign of the international community trying to put some pressure on this to stop this a cessation of this violence, or are you hearing anything that gives us anything to be hopeful about?
Actually, we heard a lot of voices from international community yesterday when the Al Jazeera and Associated Press office was targeted. This make like a new shock for international community to know that they are targeting media. But I don't know why they moved, because there was a huge massacres that were happening for civilians in Gaza. Why they just moved when this building? It's a mere building. I know that it's important. That it is important for us that show for the world what is happening. But massacres happened and many Palestinians killed. Anyhow, this is important. This is good to know that they are now feeling concerned about what is happening. The type of deconstruction or the destruction that they saw is huge. And this is for Palestinians. It is good that they saw that and they started to move and to speak out.
Hannah, we heard missiles during the week fall very close to where you were. Are you still living at home with your family? Are you still safe where you are? Or is the place damaged?
Actually, I don't know where to go. If we want to move our destination from this home, to where to go? My uncle's houses, my relatives' houses, my friends' houses are all facing the same situation. I think that they, as I mentioned yesterday, they have cleared all the facilities that are used by militants and the government. I mean, the government, meaning the administrative operations that it do for its civilians, the Ministry of Interior, a prison, Ministry of Finance, some residential towers in my area were all targeted. Some agricultural lands that they use for launching rockets by the resistance factions also targeted. So I think that they have cleared every target that they want to strike here in my area. But anyhow, the number of strikes in the area is still high. The Israeli Navy are shelling near the beach. No one in the beach for sure, but our house is near that. And they are trying to operate the shelling from the Navy in night, making extra concern and terrifying people, especially for children. Yesterday, it was hard for young people, for us, because the house was moving as if there is an earthquake that is not for a few seconds, it's for minutes. More than 10 rockets in 1 minute that shake the area, and it as if it is just a few meters from you. All my family were yesterday sleeping in approximately.
Oh. I think we've lost Hannah. We may get her back hopefully in the next couple of seconds.
I think like one of the things I was thinking about is she was talking. She made the point about a third wave of COVID, and like, as if this isn't unbearable and horrific enough, you know, those families that are currently have loved ones in hospitals with COVID are like, what it's going to do to have an increase. Like, that just kind of terrified me. I was just going to ask her about that, because like, that's just.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I don't know why I'm losing the connection, but the last point that I was mentioning, that yesterday was terrifying. Me and my family members, we were 7 members. We slept near the door on 2 meters just away, just to flee when it is needed. We don't know when we will move. And in the morning, I found that all my friends in the area were the same. When you hear the strikes, you think that it's just a few meters away from you. It is not far away as in the media. The rocket is not only targeting a building.
Sorry, Hannah, we've lost you again. Michelle, you wanted to make a point, I think.
Yeah, I'm just so shocked, not shocked, but just it's harrowing to listen to the experiences that Hannah is going through. I had been following this very young guy, a rapper called MC Abdul, online for the last year or so, and he actually put out a video yesterday morning, I think, recording a rap about his experience as an 11-year-old amongst the rubble. It was just really, like, it really kind of brings it home to how badly this is affecting children of all ages, and obviously all of the children that have lost their lives. And I think the piece around, like, obviously the electricity being cut off and the water being an issue, it really kind of, like, this is not new as well. Like, I've been to Palestine and I've seen some of the situations around there with water. Like, the Israelis have had control over the water infrastructure in Palestine since the 60s. This isn't something new, and they've been using that as kind of like apartheid essentially for years, and now we're seeing again them tackling or targeting the structures that allow them to live in the space and forcing them out. It's actually quite shocking.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. Just Hannah, if you're still there, you were talking about your family live, you know, everybody within 2 meters of the door, and we were on the phone for about over half an hour yesterday, just as you were waiting for a missile strike to hit up the road. It was, for me, it was a shocking way to go through anything. How is everybody now? Your family, is everybody was okay after last night?
I think that we are all, like, we don't feel it, but we are all sick. This morning, I just saw my eldest sister. Her face was yellow. I don't want to scare her, but she seems that she's still in a horrific situation. She was not feeling good when she heard the airstrikes. And when we were following the news, they said that they targeted buildings with the residents were sleeping at 1 a.m. And until the moment, they are still taking them out from under the rubble. So when you are even following the news, even if it is not near your home or in your home, it is not easy to follow up how the massacre is happening. You feel that, okay, they are gradually are closer to your area, to your home. They are randomly targeting. You don't know who is the next target that will be, because they did not target one person or one flat or one building. They destructed 3 or 4 buildings in the same moment. And the rescue teams are suffering because they don't have the capacity to deal with this much of rubble to remove the dead bodies from there.
Hannah, I'm just Harry, did you want to make a comment before we...
Yeah, I did. And firstly, thank you, Hannah, and solidarity. The situation is just awful. And I think there was just something you said that was really... I thought it was really revealing when you talked about the bombing of the building that contained Al Jazeera and the AP, the Al Jalla building. I think I probably got that pronounced that wrong, so apologies. It really symbolized something of just how normalized and depersonalized the way we view the violence in the Israel-Palestine situation, and particularly that seems to visit on Gaza on a 5-yearly basis at this point. That it's so normal for people, it just kind of fades into the background of the horrible things that happen in the world. And then when it happens to a news agency that people in the West identify with, that suddenly kicks them into action and raises concern in the international community. And I just want to say thank you, because it's so important that we have, you know, voices like yours, people who are able to actually tell that story on that human level and show people what's going on beyond just numbers and statistics and institutions on a sheet that people can look at and kick around as a football. So I just want to say thank you for this. And I think it's so important that voices like yours get put forward and elevated to actually, you know, tell us what is, you know, what is happening and what is the real situation for the individuals who are affected by this. Because it's awful. It really is, in solidarity to you.
Thanks, Harry. Hannah, I know we let you, if you want to head on, you can. If you want to hang on, we will discuss more things later on, but we really appreciate it. And I know, as I said to you yesterday offline, there are literally thousands of people who've been inspired by you raising your voice and helping to get that message out there. So don't forget that. It really has made a difference to so many people to see what's happening, and conversations have happened that haven't happened before. We really appreciate it. Solidarity is something, but we are all people are raising their voices, and you helped us do that. So thank you. How do you move on? I am going to move us on, unfortunately. I want to, and funnily enough, he's actually here and he's not going to be happy now because I've just moved him up to panelists. But housing is very much back on the agenda in Ireland. And Killian Woods has probably the story of the day in terms of the Irish government actually investing in the funds that we're told they want to rule out. Killian, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Not too bad. I don't know how the likes of Gavin Riley use Twitter when it's this many notifications. They're just nonstop.
I was looking at it was almost every fortnight you had a scoop on housing in the last while anyway.
Weekly.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say weekly. So, sometimes you're just refreshing old stuff, but usually very, you know.
This story is not new, and I think I've seen some people point out this, and I shouldn't highlight this, but like maybe you should take the credit when it's coming. But this stuff is publicly held information. When I was nearly annoyed at myself when I didn't spot it earlier, thinking like this was the story of last week. Well, although we did have more stuff last week about approved housing bodies getting squeezed out as well. But this is just public health information covered for years in the news. I think it's just really struck a nerve. And a lot of, not to get all media analysis on it, but a lot of this is just the packaging up of it. You know, it's used, and I know people complain about using emotive language, but like it's just, that's what these are, housing estates. I think it's really settling with people now. And I have to rein myself in from using words delivery. You know, you should say the word construct or build, or not say units, say homes, because that's what they are. I think we're kind of, some of the, even myself, I'm falling victim to using the language that would kind of maybe desensitize people to what these are. And as I think I was listening to Gav Riley's show just before this, and there's a long spiel trying to explain a lot of it because it is very complex,
It's not that complex.
But it isn't
though.
As well, yeah.
I
see now there's government spin trying to get into long grass saying there's forward financing, all this stuff. Absolute, like, nonsense. It's just absolutely not nonsense. The timelines don't match up. This fund was set up in December 2018 that bought these homes in Maynooth, and these homes were already being constructed. So how, and a month after they bought them, the first home started to be delivered. So how could you possibly be forward financing a home that was already under construction? It's just nonsense. But sorry, I cut across your question there, Tony.
No. So just for listeners' benefits, this is, again, the state putting 225 million effectively into a fund in 2018-2019 to buy properties that are in these funds that we're told their state are now going to move against to prevent them doing that. This was, not to labor the point, but if you've been listening to this podcast for a number of years, you know that this has been policy. So it's now just been dressed up. It's now just caught the public imagination. I know Rory Hearn likes to take the credit for that, but we will give him some credit because Killian, can I ask, I met you at a housing conference a couple of years ago, and we knew this stuff was happening then.
My last public event, yeah.
Yeah. Back when you could do those things. Are you surprised now that now it's, you know, we've moved so quickly from COVID and housing has just caught the public imagination, and are you surprised that this is where we've gone now?
I'm surprised that it's maybe taken this long, and I'm surprised people aren't more mad about the apartments being bought up, and I see some logic there in that, and I'm a believer apartments are a home, and especially now if there's not these if starter homes in Maynooth have been bought up, then we need to start looking at maybe one bed and two bed apartments as the new starter homes. Even I was didn't argue with me last because like these aren't homes or these aren't houses, these are duplexes, but like their own door properties. Like we're in the long grass discussing what is a, like it's a roof overhead where you have bedrooms. Like really, we're getting, this is where I think I hit a wall thinking that you come up against these people who are just ideologically opposed to or have some vested interest in all of this taking place. Like I'm struggling to understand why now, other than the kind of maybe the fact it's Maynooth. I don't think it's necessarily a middle class thing that's affected, because Maynooth is the fallback option for usually a lot of people. Not that there's anything wrong with Maynooth, I'm just saying that's where people see if they can't buy anywhere else, Maynooth is where I'd live. And Maynooth,
it's better than Ashburn.
Killian, those pyrite problems, they're all gone. They're gone.
Can I ask a question, Killian? And I'm going to use emotive language because I think it is an emotive issue. But we are seeing what I would call foreign entities buying over vast plots of residential properties in Dublin. And now we have, in the whole country, but we have our own government backing them. I mean, this rings of what Jim Larkin warned us about all of those years ago. It absolutely rings of it that we will be controlled, still controlled by another state, by another entity outside of our own state. And I spoke to the junior minister on housing during the week, and he said people don't care where the houses come from.
Paul McAuliffe, and you and him, and that'll be out on Patreon later, folks.
He said people don't care where the houses come from. I think people care very much.
It's looking the complete wrong way. It is like I've heard that before. Like it's this argument, like, oh, no one cares as long as social housing is delivered. Yeah, but if it's driving up the prices of everything and it's all coming from the what's meant to be the traditional buyer's market, of course I care where it's coming from. Like, it's just nonsense. Like, people say, oh, but they don't care about the rents they're paying as long as they have a nice roof over their head. That's individually looking at it. But you're locking people into, like, again, into the kind of the middle class, the people who can't go into social housing, locking them into these unaffordable rents. I just don't understand where it's the classic thing. Even on Brendan O'Connor this morning was said, you know, oh, but do we just don't have a rental society? Is that the problem? Like, people need to get over it and rent. It's like, this nonsense. Like, what's going to happen when all of these millennials who couldn't afford property or afford it too late in life now don't have money to spend on restaurants, to go on holidays, to go on any, like, to spend on just the basics. And this normalization last week of Conor Skehan saying, you know, 50% of your wages on rent is normal. That's defined as housing poverty. Like, that's not a normal amount of money to be spending on rent. Sure, if you're, and then people say, oh, that's contextualized. Like, yeah, it's contextualized if you're a millionaire, if you earn $1 million a year and you're spending $500,000 on property, then of course you have 500 grand left over. That's a bit different. We're talking about the normal workers here. Where are they going to, there's going to be no money to put into the rest of the economy. Like that's the reason, like, my parents, my mom, my nana is able to afford to get by on the smaller pension because she has her property. She doesn't have this huge €1,900 rent in Maynooth over her head.
And it's a big thing, like, you know, and I think it is coming out a bit in the conversations in the last week or two about, like, that quality of living and what we're entitled to expect and what we're, you know, I'm single in my 40s renting in Dublin. Like, if I want to, like, not live with some random stranger, I have to spend like $1,500 a month on rent, you know? And it's like that thing I think is interesting coming out about, like, there's a lot of people sitting in their homes, their families, their double incomes, and that comparison, like, that there's no, I'm not sure where I'm going with that.
But. Yeah, like, I completely empathize with and even the way I use first time buyers sometimes, and it's not even just first time buyers we're talking about any buyers.
Yeah.
Same with single people, completely overlooked in a lot of the policy. Like, talking to the land development agency recently, John Coleman, their CEO, I was just saying, like, you realize that your one beds for a cost rental are aimed at, in Dundrum, are aimed at singles essentially, are €1,000 a month. How could you possibly stand over that as cost? What world is that cost? Is that cost rental? And what world? And it's like, well, that's just market rent. But the market's broken. You can't base yourself on a market that's broken. That's just completely flawed. And just, like, do you realize that is, like, the majority? Like, look at the wages that you expect people to be in. That's about people in the 30, 38, maybe 45 grand a year. But, like, that's a significant chunk of their wages. That would leave them in the kind of housing poverty. There's loads of different definitions of housing poverty, but essentially that housing poverty bracket.
And like, yeah, that is anti-competitive, like, collusion, isn't it, across the market? You know, we wouldn't accept it for other basic goods and services. And we
and these generations that we're in now are going to be living with the austerity of essentially the post-pandemic. So now the higher rents, large amounts of austerity, second life-changing recession of our lifetimes. I don't understand why they can't just see, we need to, this is completely screwing over the country. Same with the funding that was put into these, the investments that were put into these were by the Irish Ireland Strategic Investment Fund. That's meant to have the Irish people's interest in its best start. It's meant to invest in that for a long-term future for its people. How could it? It's a bit of a motive again. They betted against their own people.
And I think
they took an investment bet against their own people.
And I think
make money for their own people. It just is bonkers.
I think that really shines out that they have bet against us. They have bet against their own people. And I'm going to move us on a little to Michelle. Michelle, they also bet against us in employment legislation. And the Debenham workers are completely bet against.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to come in on the housing piece as well.
Like, please do.
Like, as a renter, like a young renter in my 20s, like, you know, they're not giving us proper options for renting. We've no security. Like, obviously people are going to want their own home because there are no options for long-term secure leasing of houses, even in a rental situation. Like, I'm a member of CATU, and we're seeing a huge burst over the pandemic of members coming in. It was just set up during the pandemic, and people are trying to organize in that kind of a union sense as well, where they're like, well, the government isn't protecting us. You know, everything is stacked up against us. So we're organizing together, and people power is what's going to get us. And I suppose that leads to another people powered fight as well, was in Debenhams. And I've been kind of supporting some of the ex-workers down there on the picket the last number of weeks, to say 400 days. We've just gone past 402 days now as of today. And I suppose on Monday night down here in Waterford, I got a call just past midnight where I'd been told that two KPMG guys and three heavies, as they were described, had entered the building to where the stock was. And as I ran across the city to Waterford, down to the picket, I was arriving at the same time that some scab workers had arrived, and the guards subsequently arrived at the same time. It was almost like it was organised in advance for everyone to arrive at the same time, the guards with the workers and the security. So, yeah, it was definitely a coordinated response preempted by KPMG. It was to the letter. They arrived with large vans and tried to start negotiation with the workers, but that was merely just a distraction for them to actually unload the van of all the barriers that they were closing off the roads with, and then like bringing in more vans with public order guards in them. So essentially the guards were trying to do this, play this whole like, oh no, we're your friend, we want to facilitate your protest, you know, you've a right to protest, of course, and we're here to help. And like, that was, you know, that was all well and grand, while at the other side they actually had two vans full of public order police dressed in very different uniforms, very different police response, as they marched up to us sitting on the ground all linked in arms and lifted us off, one guard per limb, and lifted off workers, ex-workers who are close to retirement age in their 60s and 50s. One guy was 70, was lifted off by his arms and legs in an official union dispute. And like, I raised a question. It's like, this is an official union dispute. Why is this happening? And he was saying, the guards are saying, you know, we've got a court order in February. That's what we're acting on. And I said, so you're saying that companies can just pay for a court order through the judicial system and use that system against us in an official union dispute. And that just supersedes any kind of union laws at all, union protection at all. Like, that was, yeah, it was just, yeah, it was such a, an eye-opening experience to see that, like, and be in. And I was live streaming the whole thing, so people can see me being carried off by my arms and legs and being dropped and all the things.
See, like, I have to say, I'm not surprised by that. I've known this for a very long time. We had
everything.
We've always had historically weak unions in Ireland, and the Programme for Prosperity and Fairness weakened them even further. And I look at them and I'm so disappointed in the union movement, so utterly disappointed in it. And I think I look back and I think how the Teamsters grew in America. They bust heads. That's how they grew. And that's how they grew. They went in, they occupied places, they ran scabs out of places. The guards did come along, or the American cops did come along, but they stood their ground.
But even before that, I mean, I really noticed this working in the UK in higher education. Like, the unions were engaged, they negotiated on an ongoing basis. The issues that were being, like, continually being picked up. And I just see stuff happening in higher education here and nobody's batting an eyelid. So, like, even before you get to the protest sites, like, that ongoing work that unions should be doing. And I just don't see it happening. But Michelle, I did want to come in as well, because, like, just to be real about this, like, you've said to me during the week, like, you are recovering from bruises that you received from that incident on Monday night, aren't you?
Yeah. Like, I don't think my arms are used to being stretched in all of those directions. And I was dropped while I was being carried. And you can actually hear on the stream saying, you know, re-grab her. So that was very much the handling that was being happening. I was being carried by my arms and legs in the air. Like, it was bizarre. It's not like, I can't say I didn't expect it, because we'd seen what the response was on Henry Street and how people were being carried in the same way off the picket. But there was no question about the stock being moved that night. The guards told us that we're going to call the trucks in now and the stock is going to be moved. It wasn't a question. It was happening. They were facilitating. It was completely them facilitating a strike breaking thing. And something really strange as well, like the two truck drivers, one of the trucks had a Northern Reg, which obviously makes me think that they're bringing the stock up the north to be sold in the shop that's still up there. But the other thing was, the two truck drivers had brought kids in the front of the trucks with them. There was two kids in one truck and one in the other. They were definitely under the age of 16. I'm going to say put them around 15, who were helping move this stock, which I found very uncomfortable, very weird situation to bring kids into a strike breaking situation. But that's what happened. The whole thing, and I will come back, Martin, as well, what you're saying, and just the piece on the unions. Like, we are the unions. Like, union members are the strength of their unions. And, like, I will say that I know the girls on the picket down in Waterford anyway have been putting the pressure on the officials who are working on this full time, putting in what they want to be done. And it's the power of them demanding what they want to happen at these sites is so important. And I think, I know a lot of people will look at this and be disheartened about what's happening, and maybe they expect more from the involvement of the officials. And absolutely, I definitely could say the same. But I think people need to remember, if you are a union member, how active are you in your union? How much are you demanding of your union? You are the union. And don't ever forget that, because if we start third partying the union, the only person that's going to benefit that from that is the companies, the private companies that are on the other side. If we have three partners in this, you know, the union members, the union staff, and the bosses, then that is only divide and conquer tactic. We need to use the power that we have in our unions and make the unions go in the direction that we want to. And obviously, that is in a more radical position, more radical direction. And yes, obviously, there are laws in place there that really hinder some of the, you know, the way that we can protest. And we are seeing that, obviously, in the Debenhams examples. We're seeing it. There was kind of murmurs around the ESB disputes around how we can protest, and like having to give the people 2 weeks notice for a ballot and like basically let them plan their own strategy against us. Whereas before, people used to be just able to walk off site and down tools and whenever an issue happened, and then it was resolved much more quickly. And that power and that visual power that people saw union members taking action with their union and having immediate responses is really lost now. And it's coming, kind of goes back to the 1990 Industrial Relations Act. But also, don't think that's an excuse either. I don't think there's more ambition there that should be used within our unions, but it is up to all of us union members to make that happen.
Yeah, I think Martin gets on his high horse. Don't mind him. I'm glad you put him in his box, Michelle.
Just to say, we are going to come back to cover the policing dimension of this on Police in the coming weeks.
Harry, did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, no. I'd just say I think what Michelle says there at the end is the most important thing in all this. That, like, structurally, it's difficult for unions and union members to operate. The entire way that we have everything set up, from the legislation surrounding balloting to the way police deploy the monopoly on violence that they claim to have, is entirely designed to neutralize and mitigate the damage, and I use that in very heavily inverted commas, that unions do to the general functioning of the capitalist market economy. Unions are treated under law as an inconvenience, and there's no obligation on many employers to even recognize unions in the first place. When they go into a dispute, the police and the administrators act with absolute impunity. And if the unions want to do anything, or the union members want to do anything, they're heavily, heavily restricted. And I think that we're going to see, unfortunately, more of this kind of thing happen. It's interesting, Martin mentioned the Teamsters. If you go back even further in America, in the 1800s, you had literal full-scale wars, essentially, between unions and strikebreakers who were called.
Martin was there.
It's always been the... it's always been thus, though. And there needs to be structural reform, and there needs to be political will to actually create this, because at the moment the playing field is so skewed that we're going to have this, and we're going to have the workers and their union reps stuck out on an island by themselves, where they're extremely hampered by the structures they're trying to interact with. And then, of course, if a union acts outside of those structures, boom, the hammer comes down. Really, really difficult. And there needs to be a re-engagement. There was perhaps, I think, an opportunity. I think many hoped for the union movement when Labour did extremely well in the 2002 election. And, well, Martin can tell you how that went, I think, better than anybody else. There needs to be a movement to do this. And there needs to be a change in how we legislate around unions, how we treat unions and requirements and the onerous burdens that are placed on unions before they can act to change, because they should be effective. They are brilliant. They do great work. And they do great work while their hands are tied. And we need to get into a position where those limits are removed and we can have an even playing field for workers when these kind of things happen.
Folks, we had a lot. We were supposed to cover the creationist boots in the DUP. We were supposed to cover the HSE hack. We were supposed to cover about seven other things. But, you know, we are running short on time. There are a few questions. We're going to, this is in terms of the podcast, that's the end of that. I'm kind of scared because Lorcan Sir and Orla Hegarty are both in the audience. And Killian, they'll probably let you know why your article is wrong on some levels.
I just spotted that. I was like, oh, crap.
But if you want to come to these live events, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We will take some questions now, and we will talk to the rest of you next week. Thanks for the support. Bye bye.